Stay tuned now on 1460 WVOX for The Ballot Box with your hosts Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin. The Ballot Box is a monthly program brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Now, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Good morning and welcome to The Ballot Box. I'm Tamar Tate and I'm joined by my co-host Nita Lubin. And we're coming to you on behalf of the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, courtesy of WVOX, 1460 AM, and our talented sound engineer, Gerald Bell. So, Nina, are you on? How are you doing this morning?
I'm on, Tamar. I'm doing fine. I'm sitting here looking out a window and wondering whether to prepare for the winter holidays, as we call them, snow, ice, and all that good stuff, or to put on my shorts and get out there because it's going to be 60 degrees today.
Well, I'm voting for shorts.
A little gardening. Okay.
I hope you're doing well, too, Tamar. I am. You know, so last month in the elections, New Yorkers voted on a number of ballot proposals, and today we're going to discuss one of the proposals that voters approved concerning our environment. Talk about being outdoors. And we have invited an expert today to help us understand it. So, Nina, can you please do us the honors of introducing our guest?
Yes, thanks, Tamar. I'm very happy to be able to introduce Professor Katrina Fisher Q, who is the Haub Distinguished Professor of Environmental Law at Pace Law School. Professor Q's scholarship focuses on climate change and sustainability. She's the co-editor of a book entitled The Law of Adaptation to Climate Change, which is a comprehensive guide to U.S. and foreign laws that pertain to coping with climate change. Not our current headline political discussions about reducing the impacts of climate change, but laws to deal with the impacts that are going to occur regardless of our current efforts to reduce them. Professor Q is also a contributing author to a just-published collection of essays entitled Environmental Law Disrupted. Her chapter focuses on the role of corporate attorneys when their corporate clients spread misleading scientific information in order to avoid government regulation. And if that sounds like her chapter should be a best-selling thriller instead of a legal treatise, in my opinion, it almost is. For those interested in reading or following up on Professor Q's work, I'm letting you know that her last name is spelled K-U-H, Professor Katrina Q. Before entering academia, Professor Q was a lawyer in private practice, representing clients in a range of environmental matters in both litigation and regulatory proceedings. She's also served as an advisor on natural resource policy to the United States Senate. Her experiences appear to have afforded her a 360-degree view of how the nation's environmental laws are created, enforced, and broken. Professor Q's multifaceted environmental law experience is why we have asked her to weigh in on New York's newest environmental law. Welcome to the Ballot Box, Professor Q. We are very glad you found the time to join us.
Well, thank you so very much for having me, and I am enormously excited that we have a new right to a healthy environment in New York that gives us this occasion to have a conversation.
Great.
So let's just jump right into that. So last month, on November 2nd, New Yorkers voted to add this sentence to the New York State Constitution's Bill of Rights. That sentence is, each person shall have a right to clean air and water and a healthful environment. And that's it. Short and sweet. Yet there's a lot to unpack there. And could you start by setting the table for us? How did this amendment come about?
So I don't really know much about the political piece of how the amendment's language garnered political will in the state legislature. But I do have a sense of the larger kind of background that led to the discussion or recognition of the desirability of amending the state constitution to recognize a right to a healthful environment. And going back, there are actually two ways that New York State can amend its constitution. The first is that every 20 years, voters in New York State are invited to decide whether to hold a constitutional convention, at which all provisions of the New York Constitution are subject through the convention process to change. As we were coming up on that vote about whether to hold a constitutional convention, the State Bar Association convened a task force, a subgroup of the Environmental and Energy Law section of the State Bar that I chaired. And we were asked by the State Bar Association to look at New York State's constitution from an environmental perspective and make our recommendations with respect to were New York's voters to vote to hold a constitutional convention, how might we recommend that they change or not change the New York State constitution with respect to the environment and why? And in that process, I will admit, before chairing that task force, I had not really had much occasion to think about the New York State Constitution and its impacts on the environment in New York. But there actually are provisions already in the New York State Constitution, not prior to the adoption of the recent language or the recent environmental rights amendment. But there were previous, not in the Bill of Rights, but in other provisions in the New York State Constitution, there are what's called the Forever Wild provision that protect, importantly, the Adirondack Park from development. There's also a general statement of policy to protect the environment buried kind of in the later provisions of the New York State Constitution. Something that became clear to me during my work with this task force was first, the task force consisted of attorneys from around the state of New York, many of whom had been working for much of their lives to protect the Adirondacks from development. And to those attorneys, they were so convinced of the importance of environmental protection for the Adirondacks that they were absolutely adamant that we not touch a hair on the head of that existing Article 14 of the state constitution, because it had proved so important in their experience to protect the Adirondacks for the long term. So one message that came out was, we have a long experience in New York that seems to suggest that there is a value to having rights expressed in the constitution. And second, as we looked around the United States, we realized there were a number of other states who enshrine rights to a healthy environment in their constitutions. And we took a deep dive into those states to see how those rights were working. And as a result of looking at that, our task force made two chief recommendations. So we said, New York, if you're going to hold a constitutional convention, first, don't change anything about the existing Forever Wild provision that protects the Adirondack Parks in the state constitution. Leave that just the way it is. But second, we should amend our constitution to add a right to a healthy environment in the Bill of Rights section of the constitution. Now, ultimately, to go back to your original question, which is, how did this amendment come about? New York State voters ultimately did not vote to hold a constitutional convention. However, there is a second route to amend New York State's constitution, which is that if two successive sessions of the legislature vote on language to amend the state constitution, that language is then presented to voters. And if voters approve it, the constitution is amended. And so my sense is that even though New York State voters elected not to hold, I'm out of time.
We will pick up on that train of thought when we get back from the break.
return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
You're on the air.
Doesn't sound right. Where's our music? Oh, very good. Thank you, Gerald. Technical glitch. So prior to the break, we were speaking with Professor Q about the recent constitutional amendment protecting our rights to a healthy environment, and she was telling us the process for getting this onto last month's ballot. Would you please continue, Professor Q?
Absolutely. So when we thought there might be a convention to amend the state constitution, some environmental attorneys working with the Environmental and Energy Law section of the State Bar Association were invited to brainstorm, to evaluate the existing New York State Constitution and consider if we were going to change it from an environmental perspective, what might we change and why? One of our conclusions was it would be really valuable to have a right in our Bill of Rights relating to the environment. Now, ultimately, New York State voters did not vote to hold a constitutional convention. However, two successive terms of the legislature adopted through a statute language to amend the Constitution. And once they did that, it became possible for New York voters to then vote on that language and amend the Constitution in that way by adopting that specific amendment language through the ballot, which is what happened this past November.
Right. Thank you. Now, once again, the provision that we are talking about is a very brief one. It simply says, each person shall have the right to clean air and water and a healthful environment. So, Professor Q, we already have on the books a slew of environmental laws, Clean Air and Water Acts, Environmental Pollution Cleanup Acts, environmental impact statement requirements prior to construction, just for example. How is this different? What does it add? How does this fit into really the thick books full of environmental laws already in existence in New York State?
So I think it does create the possibility that citizens can be more involved in identifying and prompting the filling of gaps in existing environmental laws. So although you're right that we have many complex and oftentimes quite comprehensive federal and state environmental laws, and also even local environmental laws here in New York. I'm always surprised when I teach my introductory environmental law class, students are often, even students who come into the class as law students who are interested in environmental law, are very surprised to discover how many times there are gaps between these laws or circumstances where they might not be fully protective. And to some extent, I think many people have a vision that there is some Wizard of Oz-like character sitting in a castle, making sure that we're all protected from environmental harms and exposures to chemicals that might cause cancer. But the truth is, we have a patchwork of sometimes overlapping, sometimes not entirely clear, and frankly, sometimes underfunded agencies with not enough time and money to really enforce existing laws, and we end up with gaps. And my sense is, if you look at the legislative history and our recent experience in New York prior to the adoption of this amendment, one of the motivating factors for it, to my mind, was that many in the public for the first time became aware of one such gap. And that is, if you look at our experience in Hoosick Falls, New York, with respect to contamination of residents' drinking water with high levels of PFAS chemicals. And of course, we have strong laws that are designed to prevent our drinking water from containing harmful chemicals. However, those laws aren't perfect. And the truth is, if a chemical has not yet made it onto the list of regulated chemicals, it can still be present in drinking water. And if you look at what happened in Hoosick Falls, you actually had a concerned resident who just looked around and said, gee, a lot of people, including some people in my family, have gotten cancer. And of his own volition went out and had his water tested, found high levels of PFAS chemical, brought it to the town. The town went to the State Department of Health, and they got a pat on the head saying, hey, don't worry about it. We know that chemical's there, but it's not one of the ones that's regulated yet under the Safe Drinking Water Act. We're still studying it. We've been studying it for decades, but it's legal for it to be in drinking water, so you don't have to worry about it. That's an example of a gap, emerging contaminants. And that, I think, that really visible and visceral understanding that there can be circumstances where our environmental laws leave us vulnerable in ways with which we're uncomfortable was part of what motivated the amendment. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious, under the new constitutional amendment, would that individual now have an opportunity to sue the state or sue the municipality? Or who could they sue?
So there are a lot of open questions that our courts in New York State are going to have to resolve about precisely how claims under the new amendment can be raised, by whom, and in what context. I can suggest, however, a couple of possibilities about the way. If we were going to rewind time, we do this in tort law all the time. It's called a counterfactual inquiry. Imagine how the world might have been different if New York State had already had a right to a healthy environment in its Bill of Rights. And the first possibility I'll suggest to you is that we might not have gone as long as we did without effective regulation of PFAS. Why? Because the existence of that environmental right might have emboldened citizens, environmental interest groups, and regulators to take action earlier on a chemical with respect to which there was a growing and increasing volume of data about health effects. And the second thing to keep in mind is that if you are I imagine we might have some listeners from Long Island, if you are someone who discovers, for example, you have 1,4-dioxane, which was another emerging contaminant we've since discovered.
We will return to Long Island after this commercial break.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
There we go. Welcome back to The Ballot Box with our guest, Professor Katrina Q. Before the break, Katrina was telling us, using Long Island as an example for how one would approach cleaning toxic substances with the amendment and without the amendment. Would you mind giving us that counterfactual hypothetical again?
Great. So we were thinking about ways that the existence of an environmental right might help to allow citizens to push for gaps in existing environmental laws to be filled to make them more protective. And we were imagining someone like the individual in Hoosick Falls who discovered high levels of the chemical PFAS in his drinking water. And one idea I offered is that if for 20 years New York State had already had a right to a healthy environment, then at the time our regulators were making decisions about, is there enough data to limit the amount of PFAS in drinking water? Should we make that decision under our existing laws? Those decisions would have been made in the shadow of the existence of an environmental right, and public interest groups could have been able to hold it up and to push for earlier and more protective regulation. So maybe he wouldn't even have ever found PFAS in his drinking water. But once he did, the value of the environmental right is that instead of being in a position of having to go hat in hand and to beg elected officials to change something, to adopt a new law, to do something to protect him. This individual could have come forward and said, I have a right, and it's your duty and responsibility to protect it, and to come from that position of power. And I think here, in terms of thinking about other gaps in our environmental laws, there's another really important one I'd like to surface that I think an environmental right could be instrumental in helping to address. And that is, some of those opposed to the amendment of the state constitution to add a right to a healthy environment argued, we don't really have gaps in our existing laws. Those gaps that exist, they may be the intentional result of a comprehensive process. We can't do everything all the time. And so under the current laws, we have to strike a balance that's in the best overall interest of the public. And the problem that has become clear is that the way that the interest of the public, that balancing currently happens, it tends to help one type of public much more than other types of public. And I'm talking here about environmental justice and the fact that for lots of different reasons, the ways that we strike the balance under our current laws to protect what's viewed as the overall interest of the public consistently over time has imposed disproportionately high environmental burdens on the poor and communities of color. And the existence of an environmental right could be a very powerful way or tool to try to address that. And to give you, for example, we have, if you live in a community where there are many different permitted facilities, each of which individually complies with the environmental laws, and perhaps regional air monitoring shows that there isn't a problem, but you can show that because you live at an intersection that has six different permitted facilities in its vicinity, you are exposed to very high levels of toxic air pollution. Arguably, then, maybe that's legal. Under all of our existing laws, that's permissible and that's legal. But the next time someone goes to apply for a permit to put more pollutants in the air in that neighborhood, one argument that would be available is to say, wait a minute, I have a right to a healthy environment. I have a right to clean air. And the air is clean where I live.
Professor Q, I have a question. So if this person, this hypothetical person that you're referencing, would now have this right to go, to say, okay, I have this right to clean air or clean water, and that right isn't being met, one of the questions about this amendment is it doesn't actually define what clean or healthful is, and it also doesn't spell out like enforcement mechanisms or penalties for violations or roles for existing state agencies. How does that all get filled in?
Tamar, I have that question, and I'm going to interrupt you. I have that question, too, but I am so struck by something that Katrina just said, which is that you can be surrounded by six contaminant-spewing factories that are all following the law. They're not breaking any rules. Without this amendment, there ain't much you can do, because no laws are being broken. But if you have the right to healthy and clean air, and I want to get to your question too, Tamar, you now can do something. Even though the factories are completely compliant and doing everything right, you have some leverage to get yourself a better atmosphere. And that is, to me, that's like the big light that's going on and off, that this constitutional amendment will now permit. That's all.
Absolutely. No, I agree 100%. I'm just wondering how your right is defined. What is this term clean? What is this term healthful? What does it mean in the context of all the existing legislation, and how are courts going to define it? And do we want the courts making those decisions? So we're laying this all at your doorstep.
So there are a couple of ways to think about it. And I think it's much of the time, I would imagine that when courts are asked to evaluate whether something satisfies the requirement for clean air, clean water, and a healthful environment, they will do that largely with reference to existing standards, existing laws. However, I would point out there's an interesting concept and sometimes those inquiries are going to be very difficult, toxicological inquiries best made by expert agencies. There is a concept in tort law that I think is useful to think about here, which is in a medical malpractice case, you usually have to go out and get expert testimony, an expert to testify about whether a wide-cut laryngeal procedure satisfied the duty of care. However, there are some kinds of medical mistakes that are so obvious that the jury doesn't need medical testimony. So, for example, if someone operates on the wrong leg or leaves a sponge inside you. And sometimes I think what can happen is there can just be a mismatch between societal democratic preferences with respect to risk exposure and kind of the way that's implemented under some of our very complicated environmental laws. And to go back to the example of PFAS, the reason we spent decades stuck in a churn of EPA just studying and studying and studying the chemical was partly because the chemical companies that had been manufacturing it had suppressed information and frankly lied about the effects of the chemical for many, many years. And it got to the point where you could be an average person, find this chemical in your drinking water, go Google it online and know, I know that maybe the answer is not definitive yet, but I don't want to be exposed to this stuff. And that, to my mind, suggests that it's not always just, and we don't always just have to rely on and defer to experts with respect to what is clean air, clean water, and a healthful environment. We as citizens and people can also have valid perceptions of our own desire to be exposed to risk.
Okay,
thank you. We will return shortly for our last segment.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hi, welcome back. Once again, we're speaking with Professor Katrina Kuh about the new constitutional amendment to the Bill of Rights that says each person shall have a right to clean air and water and a healthful environment. Now, Professor Kuh, we know there have been many, many environmental lawsuits in the last three or four decades. And I'm wondering, is this amendment going to cause even more? Does it increase opportunities for citizen enforcement of our environmental laws in addition to the suits brought by environmental agencies? And I guess as an additional thought, could suits by private citizens now be directed against private parties? I know that's a lot to unpack, so I'll let you unpack it any order you like.
But it's actually something we spent a lot of time thinking about in the run-up to the vote, because a lot of people were worried about it. Many, many people were worried about the possibility that adding this right to the Constitution might lead to just a flood of litigation. But I think there are a variety of reasons to think that that isn't really much of a concern, particularly in New York State, and I'll describe what they are. So first of all, if you look at other states that have environmental rights like these, there just hasn't been a flood of litigation. It's not that there aren't lawsuits, but they're not particularly numerous. Second, you can look to New York State's history of litigation under its existing and other constitutional provisions. So, for example, to go back to your question about how do we define what's a healthful environment, well, our Constitution guarantees a sound basic education. That's something that courts have had to opine on to basically identify here's some minimum standards. And our courts in New York have shown themselves to be quite effective at defining the contours of constitutional rights in ways that are respectful of legislative prerogatives. The judiciary doesn't overstep its bounds, and it doesn't invite a huge flood of litigation. But maybe the most important piece for people to understand, and I'm making a prediction here based on my understanding of state law as it pertains to the Constitution, but I think the best reading of this right is that it is applicable, it would provide a basis for suits against the government, but not against private parties. So in other words, if you were a resident and there was a power plant going forward that needed a permit, you might be able to invoke the environmental right to try to persuade the state to not grant the permit. However, if there's a polluter down the street from you putting a toxin into the air, this right would not provide you a basis to sue them directly. I also think it's unlikely that this right gives rise to a damages remedy.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, so I wouldn't be able to sue my next-door neighbor if they're using some kind of gas-powered leaf blower and I feel that it's impacting the quality of my air. That amendment
Correct.
Isn't going to give me the right.
Correct. You
okay.
would have to go. You could raise the right in advocating in front of your town council that they should adopt a law that prevents the use of leaf blowers because if you find that it's impinging enough on you. But that would be the context in which to do it. Now, again, I'm making a prediction based on my reading and understanding of case law. And ultimately, the last response to your question about litigation is I do think it's fair to expect this is a new right. It's going to take some initial litigation in the first kind of decade of its existence for courts to define its contours, who can bring a claim, in what context, what does it require to bring a claim, and to flesh all of that out. So I would expect a period of initial litigation to define the contours of the right where there might be more cases than we would typically expect over time once people start to understand the framework and content of the right.
Do you think that in the end, this constitutional amendment is actually going to make it easier to get a healthy environment?
Absolutely. And I think probably the biggest reason, and we haven't touched on this, is that looking at states that have these rights, I have often talking to practitioners and people who work on the environment in those states, they say the benefit of these rights isn't really in the blockbuster cases that you hear that come out of the court. The benefit is in supporting the everyday decisions and activities of our state environmental agencies as they apply existing laws on the books. And to give you a for example, so New York State agencies just denied air permits for two fossil fuel-fired plants, in part on the grounds that their contribution of greenhouse gas emissions wasn't consistent with our Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. In defending those decisions, our environmental agencies can now say our interpretation of this statute and our decision here is supported both by the statute itself and by the fact that we have an obligation to protect the right of New Yorkers to a healthful environment and clean air, and that our decision is consistent with that. So I think it will not only potentially help fill gaps in environmental laws, but more importantly, help support the robust enforcement and implementation of the great laws we already have on the books and give our really hardworking regulators at the State Department of Environmental Conservation additional authority and guidance about the direction they should go when implementing these laws.
You know, the Westchester County Legislature passed a resolution in October, their climate emergency resolution. I'm not sure if you are familiar with it, Katie? My guess is yes, but I'm not entirely sure. But it urged the resolution pledges a revised Westchester Climate Action Plan, new recommended action steps, an effort at the county level to support action at the local and as well as state and national levels to address the climate crisis and its impacts. And although this came a month before the constitutional amendment was passed, I imagine that that constitutional amendment, you know, can really give this resolution a good, solid kick in the pants, you know, moving it into firmer, stronger actions. Any thoughts
Great.
On that?
I think that's, well, so first of all, I'm not familiar with the resolution, but I absolutely think they are on the right track. So I'm part of a group of environmental law professors around the country. We get to get together every 2 years to talk and then talk about what we think the most pressing issues in environmental law are and produce a book. Our most recent meeting in July, we talked about the fact that, in our sense, from following the science, talking to the scientists, we need to actually be preparing not for a 1.5-degree warmer world, not for a 2-degree warmer world, but something more in the neighborhood of 3 or 4 degrees of warming, mm-hmm. which is truly transformative in terms of the society we have. And it is an emergency.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I do, that's an interesting point and one that I had not thought that much about, but that the existence of the constitutional right in New York can also firm up and provide additional backing and support for local climate action and local environmental action.
Mm-hmm. We hope.
Go ahead, Nina.
No, just we hope.
One of the things, you know, that struck me the first time I saw this when I was in, you know, ready to vote was how brief it is, you know, and we've discussed that it's really just a sentence, and that there's so much filler that has to be provided after the fact. And I was interested to learn that when they proposed the amendment, the legislature just said, we're going to reference the constitutional provisions of these other states. I think they were like Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Montana, all these states that already had similar provisions. And they just said, okay, New York's amendment is going to follow those models. Do they all follow the same model for us, for New York to be following?
So Montana's language is very, very similar to the language we adopted in New York. The language of the Constitution, the Environmental Rights Amendment in Pennsylvania, has one additional piece to it, which is that it explicitly articulates a trust duty on the part of the government. In other words, says that the Pennsylvania state government holds their natural resources in Pennsylvania in trust for current and future generations.
Mm.
In terms of, you know, we had a lot of debates on our task force thinking about the potential wording of a right. And on the one hand, the more narrow and specific you get in the language, the less flexibility and the less broad its potential application can become. So, for example, the forever wild provisions in New York State Constitution that protect Adirondacks Park are incredibly detailed, lengthy, and specific. It's great from the perspective of that makes them easier to enforce. On the other hand, that means they're focused narrowly on protecting the Adirondack Park. We're now in a position where all of that great language about protecting the Adirondack Parks is going to be for naught if we can't get our climate crisis under control.
Mm-hmm.
So we may not be developing in it, but if we can't address the broader, bigger environmental harms that we're experiencing, mm-hmm. it's not going to do us any good.
Right.
I do
so
think there's a
trade-off. It's intentionally short and sweet.
Oh. Professor Katrina Q, thank you for being here with us today to really make sense of a very short sentence that could be a very powerful tool in our New York State Constitution. And thank you for leading the task force that got it into the Constitution in the first place. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
And join us for the next Ballot Box, listeners, on January 19th. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays
to everyone.